All right, welcome to Speak for Yourself. I'm Jason Whitlock. That's Marcellus Wiley, that dude. Coming up, we'll tell you if Jerry Jones is being too loyal to Dak Prescott.
And I've got another installment of the Emmy Award-winning Dat Dudes Dudes. But we start every day with a Whitlock. What you got today, big dog?
Oh, 8 years ago, on October 29th, I wrote a column about Notre Dame coach Brian Kelly and a student videographer, Declan Sullivan. The column started with these words. There are some mistakes coaches can't survive. Brian Kelly made one Wednesday. I was wrong. Kelly survived the unnecessary death of Declan Sullivan, who died when the 50-foot scissor lift he manned tipped over in 50-mile-per-hour winds during a Notre Dame practice. 8 years later, Kelly is a raging success at Notre Dame. He has ND on the brink of a second appearance in the college football playoffs. Nearly everyone would argue Notre Dame did the right thing sticking by its first-year coach in 2010. I'm sure the University of Maryland Board of Regents used the Notre Dame situation as a guide on how to deal with their head coach, DJ Durkin. Yesterday, Maryland announced Durkin would survive the unnecessary death of 19-year-old offensive lineman Jordan McNair. McNair died of a heat stroke this summer while going through summer conditioning. He was called the P-word and verbally abused while trainers ignored his clear signs of physical distress. Maryland strength coach Rick Court has been scapegoated for McNair's death. Maryland paid Court $315,000 to go away. The school would owe Durkin $5 million for leaving. Maryland can afford it. Kevin Plank, the founder of Under Armour, is Maryland's Phil Knight, the Nike CEO who bankrolls Oregon. Plank, a former football player at Maryland and a member of the school's board of trustees, has been unusually silent on this entire controversy. It's difficult for me to believe he isn't a key figure in the school's decision to retain Durkin. If Plank wanted Durkin gone, it would happen immediately. Plank knows enough about football to realize you can't separate Durkin from Court. The strength coach is the head football coach's partner, spouse. The strength coach is hired to be the bad cop for the head coach. The strength coach is more important than the offensive and defensive coordinators. In mafia terms, the strength coach is the underboss, the enforcer. Plank knows this because he's the consigliere. Here's what Durkin had to say about Plank in 2016 in an interview with Sports Illustrated. The best way to characterize Kevin's involvement is that he's there whenever we need him. He's obviously a critical part of our success and cares a great deal about Maryland. He's there in every way possible. I make no secret of my love of football. The game teaches valuable lessons and offers a pathway to success for guys like me. But today I'm saddened and embarrassed for the game. Winning, or the possibility of winning, cannot trump absolutely everything. I don't believe DJ Durkin or Brian Kelly are bad people. I don't think we should demonize them. But their survival of these tragedies stained the game and empower the critics of football and sports culture. DJ Durkin should do the honorable thing and resign. All right, joining the desk now are Joel Klatt and Bucky Brooks. Marcellus, I'll start with you. I believe DJ Durkin should resign here. The Board of Regents, the Maryland power structure has let him down in the game of football down. The guy should walk away.
I don't think he should. Sensitive topic here because a loss of life obviously occurred on DJ Durkin's watch. But after a 178-page investigation, after numerous months of intense investigation, based on intel from that investigation and his location at that moment when all of these incidents occurred, I respect their decision to put him back on the sidelines. I think it would be honorable of DJ Durkin right now, instead of running from this situation or stepping down, to actually restore a culture. And what is that culture? What is the culture of football that is really coming into question right now? Because I don't know if all the observers and outsiders want to know the deep, dark underbelly of motivation that comes from playing the game of football. There's a couple mantras that coaches used to always profess and we live by. One is, everything that we ask of you is not more than you can handle. just more than you expected. And that lends itself to what conditioning is. Mental conditioning, getting you tougher. Physical conditioning, get you stronger. People have to understand that in order to get stronger, you have to break yourself down. And then when you break yourself down in the process of restoring yourself, you actually get stronger, bigger, better, faster, whatever that may be. And it's a gray area and a balancing act right now that's occurring. And unfortunately, we lost a life in that process. And collegiate football has lost 30 lives since 2000 in the process of conditioning. That's a different conversation than this, but I don't think that DJ Durkin should run from that because I don't find him fully culpable.
You know, it's hard for me to say that I can endorse DJ Durkin returning to the sideline. Not only because of the incident with the kid passing away, but more so just the culture that was created around that program. When you hear the way the strength coach and coaches would talk to the players, to me, I find that unacceptable. Now, maybe I kind of have that pie in the sky view on it because I played under Mac Brown when he was at North Carolina. We had strength coaches, Jeff Mad Dog Madden. We had Rick Tootin, who also were hard on us, but they also treated us with respect. Coach Brown always had a policy where coaches couldn't curse at the players. He talked about he wanted to make sure that we were treated with class, so in turn, we would treat others with class. So for me, I don't get that, oh, I got to beat them down to build them up. No, I believe you build them up, and they'll continue to build others up. And so for me, my relationship with my coaches and Mac Brown, he was a role model. He would be a pseudo-father figure to me. If I ever had a big decision, I could call him. That's what I expect my coaches to be like. So when I hear the degrading and some of the treatment of the players at Maryland, I can't endorse a coach like that for my son or for kids that I know. I can't say Maryland's the right place for you.
Yeah, it's all of those things. Everything that's been said is true. Here's the hard part for me is that this decision by the board is going to be viewed as like, well, all they care about is winning. But if that's all they cared about, I think they actually would have done something different. And the reason is because I feel like that team is lost. There are fractures in that locker room that are not about guys playing and not playing. It's about a life lost that they care deeply about. There were guys in DJ's first meeting back and in the meeting that they announced that he would be back, players stood up and said, we're out. And they walked out, they posted on social media, they don't want to play for this man, so on and so forth. Now, there's another sector of players that have been defending DJ Durkin. That fracture is too big to overcome. This is not a starting quarterback decision here. This is a personal deal. So that's one of the reasons why I thought that this was such an interesting decision from the board. And then there's the other aspect of just how college football works, which is this. The lifeblood of every college football program is the ability to recruit. Mm-hmm. How in the world is this guy going to recruit in a competitive sense when all the opposition has to do is point at this incident and say, you don't want to go play for that? Whether it's true or not, that's just how college football works. So that's why I was actually very surprised that the board did this, and this was not in the vein of we just want to win, because I think this actually makes it harder for them to compete. Matt Canada, the interim head coach, had actually done a remarkable job, and Maryland was playing very good football this year, in part because they were galvanized by everything that happened, in particular the memory of their fallen teammate and his courage and what he stood for, Jordan McNair. And now this throws a grenade into all of that. And quite frankly, I don't know how they survive this, because even if he sticks around, again, that lifeblood is going to be taken away from you. So eventually this is going to end in a poor fashion for everybody there.
Part of the reason why I think he should step aside. When you walk into that meeting room and you see that kind of division amongst your players, that's not an easy fix. And you're already 8 games into your season. The Matt Canada has shown some level of competency. Sometimes you have to be bigger than the situation, and it can't just be about DJ Durkin and perhaps, in my view, his relationship with Kevin Plank and the support he has from the most powerful person on that campus. It has to be about the kids in that room. And if DJ Durkin can't see that he's hindering the kids in that room from having the ideal college football experience, take your money. They're going to give you $5 million. Your reputation won't be so tarnished that you can't get a job someplace else, either as an assistant and perhaps as a head coach again. That's why I think the guy should do the honorable thing and remove himself, because to me, the university and whoever's influencing the Board of Regents and the power structure have made a cowardly decision.
Well, it's interesting if you're DJ Durkin, you've been proven to stand on the side of little to no culpability, but certainly I think even the Board of Regents said, yes, he has some responsibility in this, but not the lion's share. You don't stand alone when you stand with the truth. And I think that he's sitting there feeling like, okay, I have a room full of impressionable young men who I am trying to obviously rear and get prepared for the real world. Most guys in that locker room will not be professional football players, as in any collegiate locker room, most guys. So I'm standing here right now, and I don't want to displace the blame. I don't want to push the blame to what occurred. This was a situation that wasn't provoked because of the culture. Let's be real.
How can you say that, Marcellus?
I got to tell you this. A toxic culture exists in more places than just Maryland.
No question.
Okay. And what has galvanized this conversation is obviously the loss of life because of a toxic culture, right? And through that process, the neglect that was paid because of the symptoms shown in a moment that the guy was fatigued, starting to show heat stroke, and then they didn't properly respond, correct?
Yeah.
But all those things are not all involved to the point of cause of death. And that's where, if you're going to try to blame this on the coach, then we have to keep a narrow focus to say, what did you do in that process that led to that? And the strength coach, he had to go. And because the strength coach was there in the immediate, the strength coach was there with his eyes, the strength coach was there with his instructions. What did DJ Durkin do in those
moments? He hired the strength coach.
And let's not remember now. This is not a situation where you've got 53 or 86 or 90 pros. You know, these kids are not getting paid. And candidly, and Marcellus, this is where I'll push back. I'm tired of head coaches in college football claiming that they don't know or aren't responsible for things that happen under their program when they're the only ones that are reaping the benefits of those programs. In a general sense, they're the ones with the guaranteed multi-year contracts. A lot of times the assistants don't even have that. A lot of times these guys are the highest paid employees of the state, just the school, of the entire state that they work in. So it's different. That this is a different situation. And like I said, candidly, I'm tired of coaches saying it wasn't me, I wasn't in the immediate, when it's a college, this is an academic deal, right? This is an academic student-athlete type of deal. He's got to be responsible for the way the training staff reacts, the way that the strength coach behaves, and the culture with which those individuals are treated. And listen, like I said, I think from my side of this, I understand what the report was. I understand what the responsibility was that was laid at DJ's feet. I don't want to demonize him at all. And I'm not saying he should go or shouldn't go. I'm just saying that I know one thing about football, and that is football teams generally behave this way. They only care how much you know as a coach. They only care how much you know if they know how much you care about them. And this is a fractured locker room, and I think it's going to be really difficult for him to walk in there and have the same level of effectiveness growing them into men and leaders in society in the future with this in the rearview mirror.
I respect that ideal. I just ask pragmatically, since we're being candid, which I live by staying candid, how do you execute that? Because true power is delegation and respect and actually giving you the opportunity to lead. So if I hire a staff, I'm going to also be interdependent with that staff and allow them to coach their sectors.
Because you delegated, you're ultimately responsible. That's the point of delegation. Like, you're still ultimately responsible.
Bad hires can get you fired, Marcellus.
I understand that.
Part of the expertise they're paying for is his ability to hire the right people and put them in the right environment. That again, when a kid is in that kind of distress and you're throwing the P word and you're calling him cowardly.
And that coach was.
So that coach and whoever was supervising that coach, that let that coach or that program, the training staff or wherever, think that was remotely appropriate, somebody's got to go, man.
The head coach sets the vision. The head coach sets the vision for the program. He says, this is how I want my team to be. This is how I want us to play. This is how I want us to act. He hires coaches that can carry out that vision. The strength coach, to me, is the most important coach in a college football program. He's with the players far more than their position coaches and anybody else. And so DJ Durkin had to have a conversation with the strength coach and say, look, I want you to grind on them, but here are the parameters.
Right.
Here's where it ends. And I'll say this, because Joel spoke to the fact that it's an academic environment. Coaches are teachers. The grass is their classroom, their blackboard. They're supposed to use the lessons that they teach those guys on the field to help them get better in life. All of the stuff that I read about, the language, making them eat, almost gluttonous in front of their teammates, I don't understand how at any point that is helping them become better men. I just don't get that. So I understand. I think the biggest thing will be, how does DJ Durkin come back? Because now he's hired. How does he come back? Is he humble when he comes back? Does he take accountability for what took place? Does he show the players, here's how we're going to change? That's what I want to see from him. Because now he's there, how can he make the program better?
Marcel, I'm going to add this one last, just on a personal note.
Yes.
I hired a bad part-time secretary, and it cost me.
Uh-huh.
A bad part, not someone integral to the staff, a part-time secretary, and it cost me. And I can't sit here and whine about it because I made the hire, and it was bad. It happens. This dude, the first hire he made was this strength coach. And just as Bucky said, if you college football now, the strength coach is the guy. He's the runner of the underboss. He's the extension of the head coach. It's tough, man. I got more empathy for McNair's family, the kids on that team, than I do for DJ Durkin. Whitlock and Wiley. Time for some big stories. Bucky Brooks is back, and we're joined by Fox NFL analyst Greg Jennings. All right, let's move to Amari Cooper, who is gearing up for his first game as a member of the Cowboys this week. A lot of people view Dallas's decision to trade for Cooper as a way to evaluate Dak Prescott, who hasn't had a number one receiver all year. But Jerry Jones says the move was just about helping the team win.
The evaluation of Dak is not the, as to the future, is not the issue that some would have it be. We just want to now get ourselves in a position so that Dak can execute in a game-winning way. And that's it, pure and simple. He's really had the opportunity to be evaluated, if you want to just use the word and use the exercise of evaluation.
I completely buy this, because I think Jerry's trying to help Dak, and he's trying to evaluate Jerry Jones. I mean, Jason Garrett.
Mm.
He's trying to evaluate Garrett, and he's trying to help Dak. I completely buy it.
I buy it, too. And Jerry Jones is certainly selling it. Let's just be real about that. And his nepotism is reckless at times. I have
nepotism.
Nepotism. Who runs the Dallas Cowboys right now?
Jerry Jones.
Stop playing. Who runs the Dallas
Stephen
Cowboys?
Stephen Jones?
You know it. Okay, and then nepotism is not just for relatives. It's for friends, people he likes. You ever heard of a Jerry's guy?
Yeah.
Bill Parcells has heard of a Jerry's guy. T.O. versus a Keyshawn Johnson. One was a Parcells guy. One was a Jerry Jones guy. Me, I was a Jerry Jones guy. Don't know what he was looking at, but he said, I want you on my roster. Bill Parcells was like, that's not my guy. Right now, Jerry Jones has deemed Dak Prescott as his guy. Jimmy Johnson went through this as well. He's always run his franchise with this nepotism that I love because it's loyalty, and that's the way I would run my franchise too. Don't ask me if my son qualifies. He will be the next great in this line of lineage. But Dak Prescott's not that guy, and I don't understand why he won't continue to evaluate a guy who's given us roller coaster results so far in his few years.
Oh, see, I'm all in on the Dak Prescott thing in Dallas because I believe that Jerry Jones, look, Jerry Jones follows the Al Davis theory. You talk about his guys. Mm. When I played in Oakland, Al Davis had his guys. Everyone knew on Thursday, his guys are going to practice. That might be the only day they practice that week. But when Mr. Davis comes out, his guys are going to perform. And so for Dak Prescott gave him the flashes his rookie season when he had 11 games with a passer rating over 100, and they won a ton of games. So Jerry is saying, oh, my quarterback is a franchise quarterback. I need to make sure I get him the right stuff. So now when we go through the checklist of things that they had to get him, the offensive line had been struggling. So, you know, when everyone was giving Jason Garrett a hard time of being at the World Series, he was here trying to talk to Hudson Hauk into coming back to be the O-line coach so we can solidify the front line. Mm. Got Zeke, right? Zeke is now in shape and running the ball. Need a number one receiver? Hey, let's go get Amari Cooper because we need someone on the outside who can affect coverage. So now he's saying, hey, I'm giving my guy everything that he needs so he can get us back to where he got us his rookie season. Dak Prescott isn't under evaluation. He's going to get a big contract. He's going to be the Cowboys quarterback for the next decade. Jerry Jones has basically told you that with all the moves that he's made.
Should he, though? Should he be?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's shown, when he's surrounded by the right stuff, he can win. Now, is the winning like Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers where he's going to put up 300? No. But he can drive the car and get us to the winner's circle. I think Jerry Jones is very comfortable with Dak Prescott.
Des Bryant disagrees.
I disagree, honestly. I don't think I don't think he's under evaluation yet. And I say yet because I think Amari Cooper is the one that's going to be evaluated. What can he bring to advance our offense offensively in the passing game? So we brought you here. We want to make sure that we have – you're looking at their passing offense is 29th in the league. They're 28th overall. They're struggling. Their defense, top three. Rushing, top four. So they everything is in alignment but the passing game. And now you bring in offensive linemen. You bring in Amari Cooper. You telling me if Amari Cooper's producing but it's not to the magnitude to where we feel like, wait a minute, can we get more out of our quarterback? Mm. If Amari Cooper doesn't produce, then it's still going to fall back on Dak Prescott because we're going to wonder, is Amari Cooper getting the opportunities? Is he getting the down-the-field looks? So I think he's not getting evaluated yet, but if this ship isn't righted, it's definitely going to be
I think Jerry justifiably has hitched his wagon to Dak Prescott, and Dak Prescott has hitched his wagon to Jerry Jones.
Yes.
And when Dak Prescott came out and said that what he said about the national anthem.
Hey, brother.
That was their wedding ceremony.
It was.
and so I don't blame Jerry for being this kind of loyal. Dak Prescott has earned it. He's a ride or die for Jerry Jones. Jerry Jones needs a ride or die with Dak.
Earned it. So yeah. All I got to do is say what you want to say to the public, and I earned it.
He's played well.
Hold on.
Out there on the most controversial issue of the day and stood with his own.
Well, power to the people. I don't want to. I need production, brother. Has he ever thrown for 4 touchdowns in one game? I mean, just one. Just give me one game. So no.
You're over there playing fantasy football.
You're playing for air.
Yeah, I'm playing winning football, too.
I'm talking about winning game. Look, lately? Those first two years, he was 22-10.
Respect.
He was 22-10 as a guy that was a fourth-round pick that no one expected much of. So he comes in, he wins. Then you put up those numbers. And at one time, at the end of his second season, in terms of 100-yard passing games, it was only him and Tom Brady sitting at the top.
I love
I'm just saying, Bucky, you're great at carving these numbers, but I want the whole resume, brother.
So now
we remove everything. Doesn't have anybody. He's playing with a bag of peanuts on the outside. A bag of peanuts. There's no one that you would take.
Tom Brady's name, and Tom Brady's had peanuts before. Tom Brady's a different dude. And made popcorn.
He's also had better coaching. He's also had better coaching.
Okay.
Been at it long.
Okay.
So that's the thing. Because the next guy to go is Jason Garrett.
I get you.
Because the quarterback is going to be there. I'm telling you, the quarterback is going to be there.
He will be there, but he's going to be there. Bucky, please tell me this. In this inflated NFL with the protected rules at that position and wide receiver position, didn't you expect a little more out of Dak Prescott in production?
I mean, look, I went on record and said, look, I thought he was going to do some Tom Brady-like stuff.
Right.
He's not that guy yet. He's not going to put up those numbers. This team goes through Zeke and the defense. Mm. So now, when you look at it, all he has to do is be able to make a couple plays a game in the passing game. They're going to run it 35 times, and then their defense is playing lights out. The NFC East is still there for them to take.
That's true. I get you something.
All right, we got to move on to Cam Newton, who is having one of the best seasons of his career so far, guiding the Panthers to a 5-2 record and throwing for a career-high 66% completion percentage to go along with his 17 total touchdowns. But the former MVP isn't among the front runners for the MVP award this year, with just the 9th best odds to win the award at 25-1. At the moment, Patrick Mahomes and Todd Gurley are heavy favorites, but I think Cam should be getting a lot more respect here than 9th. I think he should be 3rd on this list. I think people are sleeping on how well Cam Newton is playing. He's scoring with his legs. He's productive with his legs. Look at his MVP stats through 8, when he was MVP a few years ago. Look at the stats through 8 games, and look at this year's stats through 8 games. All of them better than in 2015. The Cam Newton, to me, is the 3rd best MVP candidate we have right now, not getting nearly enough respect.
Okay, I respect that. I mean, we should get here a little earlier together because I thought you was going to come out here and say he should win MVP. And I was like, Lord, this is not going to be a good segment for Jason Lillard. But if you want him to get the bronze medal in this, whatever they give the
right
third
place. Right now, eight games. Well, look, he can move up.
He can move up, right, but I don't think he wins this. That horse is way out there. Patrick Mahomes is... He's so far out there that we're looking at Todd Gurley like, that's cute. I mean, that's nice. But you know what? That's a shared experience. We don't know if it's Jared Goff, if it's you. We're over there minimizing Todd Gurley right now because of what we're seeing from Patrick Mahomes. And every time they put up Patrick's numbers, guess what the other faces look like in terms of historical record? Tom Brady and Peyton Manning twice. It's like, this dude is in a whole different category. So, Cam Newton, you're playing as well as you did when you won MVP, but they have moved the goalposts, brother. And Patrick Mahomes is the reason why.
I mean, Pat Mahomes is certainly the MVP, but I'll say this is the best Cam Newton has ever played in his career.
I'm with you.
What Norv Turner has done has really elevated Cam Newton's game. They're doing more short passes. He's more efficient. He's still able to be Cam Newton. They're running the ball more with him than ever. And they finally surrounded him with an upgraded cast. Look, the fact that he went to the Super Bowl with those dudes on the passing game is unbelievable. He should have been the MVP. But now he has some real guys on the outside. DJ Moore, Greg Olsen, Devin Funchess. You have Christian McCaffrey, who is one of the top scrimmage yard leaders. Cam Newton is really playing the way that we thought that he could evolve when we saw him come out of Auburn. Norv Turner deserves a ton of credit for elevating his game.
I think he's getting enough respect. I think
at ninth?
At ninth, I do. I really do. I think when you look at
Phillip Rivers.
Phillip Rivers is balling now.
Balling.
He balling now. Don't
Carson Wentz.
And their team is good. One of the stats that you left out was in his MVP year, they were 7-0 through eight games. Through week eight.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're 5-2. Right now. So winning, when you produce in the win column, your name is at the top of the list. You look at those guys, Patrick Mahomes, these teams are better than the Carolina Panthers. However, I do like Cam Newton down the stretch because I'm as much as I want to give Norv Turner credit, and I think he deserves a lot of it, I give a lot of the credit to Cam Newton because he's mature. We have not once talked about his maturity or being immature. He's on the sideline. He's going over plays. He looks like a much well-prepared, a better prepared and equipped Cam Newton, and I like what I've seen.
I'm not sure if Cam's more mature. I'm really not, and I don't say that to denigrate him. What I've always banked on with Cam is this dude is a competitor. And sitting around for the last 3 years and guys not as talented as him, getting all the love and the hype and people starting to criticize him, I always felt like Cam's not going to fold. He's going to compete. He may be stubborn about it. It may have taken him a few years to understand this is how I need to play. But eventually, Cam Newton is going to compete because his ego and his heart dictate it.
Check your Twitter right now because I could tell. Thousands of people just hit you. He didn't compete for that fumble in the Super Bowl. Shut up, people. We understand. It was one play. Hey, I ain't want my shoulder torn off either if I'm going to lose the ball. That said, yeah, he never had the personality of the protected position of quarterback. And that's what I always loved about Cam. Like, do it your way. He had a more skilled position personality, which we know when you enter the pearly gates of being a quarterback, they want to handcuff that, right? They want to groom that. And Cam Newton's like, I'm going to play it my way. And now I'm with you with like, it's not more maturity. It's just like, okay, finally you guys are coming to me because I'm balling and you're starting to respect the way I go about it.
No, that, I mean, that certainly is it. Like, after a while, he's been consistent. He is who he is, and that's who he's going to be. Now the play and the performance is such that you have to talk about what he's doing on the field rather than the antics and the flashy clothes and all the other stuff. But to that point, and taking it back to Dak Prescott is kind of like the franchise quarterback acting like you're supposed to act.
Yes.
That's why Jerry Jones is all on him.
Good
Look,
point.
Here's the thing I like about Cam, and I like a guy that can handle getting beat up. Because if you're a fighter, you're going to lose some fights eventually. Floyd Mayweather can duck everybody, and he didn't lose a fight. Real fighters, Muhammad Ali, they're going to lose some fights. And I always felt like Cam could handle getting beat up. And he got beat up bad for a couple years, and he deserved it. But I thought he could handle
it. Add another topic next segment.
Time for That Dude's Dudes, presented by Captain Morgan. You all know Marcellus is that dude. Now he's going to show us the best plays from big guys around football. Marcellus, what you got?
Time to get a big ugly some love. Not just Jason Whitlock is a big ugly. The guys in the trenches really doing it. Let's start off with that dudes. Number three, we got my Packers linebacker here, Kyler Fackrell, silence of the Rams. You can see him get that sack on Jared Goff. But you know what? That dudes beating Andrew Whitworth? Let me show you how he got this done. First thing first, Andrew Whitworth is going to get a jump, and this jump is going to actually help him. But Fackrell, look at that leg positioning. Look at the hip turn that is starting to happen. It's really throwing Whitworth off. So Whitworth throws his punch off cadence, off sequence, not in the leverage position. Uh-oh, little Street Fighter going all Ryu on him. And now you see you use all your power in your punch. Look at that extension, full extension, not affecting Fackrell. Why? Because he hasn't put that pivot anchor foot in the ground. Now, Whitworth tries one more time. I'm going to ride you past my quarterback. That's my last resort. But uh-oh, Fackrell throws his arm to turn the hips. Coach always says force the hips by the upper body torque. He does it, comes around the corner. Kyler Fackrell, number three, that dude of the week. Let's go to number two. We're going to go to the Redskins. And defensive tackle Matt Ioannidis. Count Sackula. Watch this right here. Count Sacula. You like that? My man, get hit him with that floss horn. Oh. Hey. Oh, man, he's going to break through the eye and gets Eli Manning. John Greco, he sees it. Oh, my God, he's eyeing Ioannidis right there. And as you can see, he oversteps. And now that power leg is up in the air. Oh, Ioannidis hits him with the rip move right underneath that armpit because he said, oh, you want to come out here? I'm going to go in there. And now this is one-on-one combat, all about head position. Ioannidis has to keep his head to the inside. As you can see right now, Greco's trying to fight to put his head on the other side, but he has him pinned. This is so beautiful. Look how he's trying to win the one-on-one battle before he gets to the quarterback. Too many young linemen forget that. And look at these prairie dogs out there wrestling. They are getting it in. And now it's time to serve Eli on the platter, I say. It's the battle for Eli. We know who's going to win that battle. It's my man Ioannidis. Gets rid of Greco. Now he looks. And Eli, once again, get me out. Hey, Ben McAdoo, please bench me again. Somebody come save me. Oh, too late. Eli Manning took it. Ioannidis, number two, that dude of the week. Now let's get to our number one of the week. Go down New Orleans. Defensive tackle Sheldon Rankins. Boo that. Out there in Minnesota. Ooh, look out. Kirk Cousins is going to take that L right now. And he sacks Kirk Cousins with a little bit of a power rush. Let's see how this happens right here. It's time to bench press somebody. Get my hands to the inside. Look at this full extension. Hands to the inside. A little dance move. Throw him off with that sequence right there. And then hit him with that punch. I'm in the weight room. You not, homeboy. And then he gets him with the one arm. Coach always says, I can steer you if I put that one arm on you. Superman. Check my Instagram today. Me and little man are Superman this day. And once you get that steer position, there's no recovering from that. Not only did I bench you, but I positioned you. Rankins, Sheldon, oh my God. Be nice to him out there. Number one, that dude of the week.
Love that. That was awesome.
Hi-ya-ya. Wow. Hi-ya-ya. You see that right there?
Yeah, you make me want to do this.
All right, let's get some more NFL stories. Starting in Green Bay, where the Packers were busy yesterday shipping comeback killer Ty Montgomery out of town after his disastrous kickoff return. Fumble cost Aaron Rodgers a chance to beat the Rams Sunday. They also parted ways with Ha-ha Clinton Dix, who is ranked the fourth best safety in the league by Pro Football Focus, but reportedly has been a major source of locker room strife himself. Look, this is clear to me. They chose chemistry, locker room chemistry, over personnel. They looked at what they did against the Rams, could have beat them, should have beat them. We're fine if our locker room is together. They didn't go the personnel route. I agree with the decision.
Wow. I guess I agree with the decision because I thought it was smart upstairs to get rid of two guys who were looking for contracts, and obviously you weren't going to pay them that money. So look at it from an NBA mindset. Get something for you instead of just letting you go out to a free agency and get nothing in return. I like that part of it, but last time I checked in the NFL, they weren't looking for choir boys. They weren't looking for everyone who was like, we're all on one page, one accord. And it's just weird that now No. I mean, they say they are.
Patriots are.
Look, the Patriots even do you really want to go candid on the Patriots? Because Tom Brady has some stuff to talk about. Gronkowski has some things. You really want to do this? Okay, so the whole point of it is you don't need everyone on that same page. And I think that this was just a smart upstairs move saying, hey, they don't like it here. We're going to get something out of them. Move on.
Man, I think it's tough, though, when you talk about it, because it's still a player's league. And talent still trumps everything. And I'm looking at this team in comparison to the other teams within the division. They're not as talented as those other teams. And they let two good players go. Hoglin Dix is a really good player.
Legit.
Look, Ty Montgomery is a guy without a position, but at times he's been an effective player. I think he's out of position at running back. He was better when he was a hybrid. But when they've been at their best, it's because the Packers have had good players. They overwhelm you with their talent, and they have a really good quarterback. I think the Packers need to be careful of handing too much power and control to number 12.
Say it.
Number 12 was upset. Aaron Rodgers was upset. Ty Montgomery didn't take the knee. And look, Ty Montgomery could be wrong for that. However.
Could be.
Could be. However, the Packers are built on the Lombardi days. The Lombardi days, it was all about the team. It wasn't about one player. So they just need to be careful, because we've seen players go. The next is going to be the coach. Be careful hitching your wagon to one player.
Yeah, my issue with this is we make this about Aaron Rodgers all the time, and we make this point to say, are the Packers wasting his window? Are they putting pieces around him, meaning personnel pieces? And then you take away two guys on defense that we've talked about their defense needing guys in the secondary.
Pro bowler.
They're balling in the secondary. Ha-ha, Clint Dix is one of the best in the business at that position at safety. And then offensively, a guy who's, again, he's a hybrid. He's an effective player when you do utilize him. Hasn't been as effective this year because you haven't needed to use him that much.
And he fumbled.
So Aaron Rodgers doesn't throw interceptions. Mason Crosby doesn't
not
miss field
out
goals.
Of the end zone.
All I'm saying is when you're going with chemistry, we understand the culture in Green Bay. They don't deal with turmoil inside the locker room, and they hush all of that. This would have been suppressed. I don't think they wanted to deal with it, so they got rid of him. And I think it might hurt them in the long run because you can't always replace personnel.
And they're not helping with the illness. They're just trying to address the symptoms. And you still got that issue going on in the locker room. Part of it may be the issue's over.
What's there to talk about now? He's gone.
It's about the two guys that's in there.
Yeah, since Aaron Rodgers has been there, there's always been something going on, whether it's him and the coach or him and Brett Favre. Like, from day one, that's why he dropped in the draft. Like, I love Aaron Rodgers, the player, but in terms of, like, the teammate, it just seems like there's always something. And you can't be the common denominator in all these issues, and it's not your fault.
He didn't bring it out of the end zone, and I guarantee you the 52 guys in that locker room agree with Aaron Rodgers.
And
the two anonymous
sources.
I'm going to tell you right now, if they disagreed, they wouldn't say, "I disagree with them."
And that's the culture.
That's true.
That's the problem with the culture right there, because when Crosby misses four field goals, Aaron Rodgers like, "I got your back." Everybody like, "Damn, I want to go there, but Aaron Rodgers got your back."
They rallied behind that guy.
He didn't go there for Ty Montgomery, so now everybody's like,
Did Richie Cunningham question the Fonz?
Hey,
Aaron Rodgers is the Fonz. You don't question the Fonzarelli.
Fonz was cool.
I'm Jason Whitlock. He's Marcellus Wiley. It's time to put on our thinking caps. Bucky Brooks and Greg Jennings are back with us. As you all know, I'm a journalist, and we've got our resident Ivy Leaguer, Mark Sellis, here.
Excuse me.
So we're going to take a deeper look at some of the big issues in sports. Got a special cap for our Columbia grad. Darnell, sporting the worn Central football Halloween look.
You mean worn out Central. What you got on?
We undefeated and nationally ranked, bro.
I see.
All right, put that cap on and let's get rolling. Western Michigan grad. Bucky, where'd you go to Cal?
No, North Carolina.
North Carolina, I'm sorry.
Respect.
Hey, for Mac Brown. All right, and a Ball State graduate. All right, let's move to the NFL, where Hugh Jackson was fired this week after going 3-36-1. In his 2+ years at the helm in Cleveland. With a record like that, it's hard to argue Hugh didn't deserve to lose his job, but the timing of the firing raised some eyebrows and even got some of the media worried about the state of African-American coaches as a whole, with Jason Reed of The Undefeated writing, quote, "But here's the problem. In an overwhelmingly African-American league in which almost 70% of the players are black, it's simply unacceptable that so few black people are head coaches. Many African-American assistant coaches and former assistants were upset that Jackson didn't get more time because of what the move meant for both Jackson individually and black coaches as a whole."
I get why the issue was raised, and Bucky, you had some interesting thoughts over Twitter that I'm gonna actually let you kind of set the table for this discussion, and then we'll respond to your take.
I think the article kind of outlines the fear of coaches that black coaches are judged collectively, not individually. And so when someone of color ascends to the top position, if they fail, their failure is cast amongst the community, the African-American coaching community. And so you worry about, because Hugh Jackson fails, will another guy get an opportunity to do what Hugh Jackson was able to do in Cleveland? And so the bigger thing will be, as we go forward, because Hugh Jackson came from an offensive background, and the new thing that everyone wants in the profile is, I want a young, offensive-minded coach that can develop quarterbacks. Well, guess what? If you're African-American, you don't coach quarterbacks, and you rarely coach the offense as an offensive coordinator. May not see many get opportunities in this cycle or the next cycle.
I don't think Hugh's failure impacts black coaches. I really don't. I don't think there is ownership around the league that's sitting there thinking Hugh is analogous to any of the other coaches around the league. Hugh's a different bird, mm-hmm. always has been a different bird. You know, I used to joke and call him hubris because his ego out of control. And I don't, you know, that's a coaching thing, ego's out of me. He reminds me more of Mike Martz. And, you know, Mike Martz failed as a head coach. And so I just don't think Hugh's failure impacts other African-American head coaches. Canada.
Yeah, I didn't feel that as well. Respect to the article and to what you're saying, I understand that collective. That was the responsibility that Jackie Robinson had to deal with and bear, not just being the first black player in Major League Baseball, but making sure you're good when you're a black player, because we're going to judge should we allow that opportunity to others based on that responsibility. And I don't think that right now we're down to six people of color, head coaches, that we're in that same boat. But let's be real. There's still something to what we hear in the black community a lot of, you got to be twice as good just to be equal. You know, like you, as a black coach, and this is not appropriate because timing is everything. This is a bad mm-hmm. time to bring this up when you got a coach that only won 3 games in 3 years. I don't want to hear it then. But in totality, yeah, I respect what you're saying. You said something about the quarterback position, and I want everyone to understand the evolution of that position as it used to be on the field. Of all skill positions, the quarterback was the least desirable in the 80s for me as a Pop Warner player. One, because if you play a Pop Warner at quarterback, all you're doing is hand the ball off. That's the 80s, remember? Yeah. And every brother yeah. was like, I'm playing running back first or receiver. And then we heard stories of a Warren Moon and those at the pro level. Hey, if you're a good quarterback, maybe you should try cornerback. So black players by desire didn't want to play quarterback, and by protection, the league said, this is a different position, one of mindset, one of leadership, and we felt like it was a difficult task for us to even be quarterbacks. Why do I bring that up? Because now we're behind the eight ball in mm-hmm. terms of experience at the position or expertise deemed by the others at that position. We achieved at other skill positions and didn't necessarily want to go to quarterback. So what you're seeing now is the protection of that position on the sidelines. Where's the next Sean McVay? Where's the next quarterback guru? Steve Clarkson's are out there and all these guys who are teaching 101 quarterback, but through the ranks, we need more experience and more guys with their eyes dead set on that position alone.
I mean, for me, as a former player and seeing just the Rooney Rule being implemented, that alone lets me know, number one, black coaches don't get a fair shake. Having to implement a rule to say you must at least interview a black coach or a potential coach that could be of African-American, that says it all for me. And so with Hugh Jackson, yes, collectively, it does hurt. It hurts because guys are thinking, black coaches are thinking, man, I hope Hugh is successful because he makes and helps us all. And then my issue with even the Hugh Jackson firing, yeah, he was 3 and whatever. Doesn't matter. But once he finally got the talent, he never got an opportunity to see it through. And that's my issue. It was almost like the rug was just pulled from underneath him, and probably it should have been done sooner rather than later.
All money. You got to be careful. When he took the job, I thought, wow, I don't know if I would take that job, particularly coming off my Raiders situation. Sometimes you got to take the only job that's offered to you, and it may be your only chance. But sometimes you got to hold back. All money's not good money. It's like playing dominoes or anything like that. And so I thought he took a job where it was everybody has gone there and died, from Bill Belichick to everybody. He took a losing hand. But I think we just got to be careful in a because I'm a huge Marvin Lewis fan, and I get beat up for defending Marvin Lewis because I think he's a hell of a coach. He's been there 16 years without winning a playoff game. So I think these things are all situational as we go from Sean McVay right now is the hot coach and everybody's looking for Sean McVay. Well, there was a time when Mike Tomlin was the hot coach and everybody was looking for Mike Tomlin. A lot of this stuff is cyclical. And a lot of this stuff, like anything else, is driven by success. If you have success, they'll go out and look for the next guy like you. If we have success on this show, they'll be looking for guys like us to do shows like this at other places. That's the way it works. And then the other thing, I think Jason Reed, and I just think we got to dig deeper on these stories and get to the root causes, because I hate it when we go to, well, 70% of the players are black, so therefore the coaches should be X, Y, and Z. Well, let's say you're sitting out in Silicon Valley and you're running all these tech companies, and you go, well, 90% of our employees are either white or from India. And so should therefore all the managers be from white and India? We can't use some stat to say this is what should be happening in coaching. The issues are deeper than what we're allowing. Hugh Jackson, there's been a lot of coaches fired after 1 year.
Yeah.
Not get Jim Tom Sula. Chip Kelly had success in college, had success in Philadelphia. Came out to San Francisco, got fired in 1 year. I'm not, and Marcellus, you made the point about quarterbacks, and we may get into this later in the, but other than in, I think, 2003 or 2004, there's never been a better time to be a black quarterback. Black quarterbacks are killing it right now.
And that is something very true to that. And this goes all the way back. Dr. Harry Edwards did a study way back in the late 60s, and I wrote about it in college, positions of centrality, where blacks were not allowed to play positions of centrality, meaning they couldn't play center, they couldn't play quarterback, middle linebacker, and free safety, because those were the thinking man's positions. Where if you go and you look at coaches, coaches ascend from those spots.
Yes.
They're either quarterbacks, middle linebackers, free safeties. That's where the coaching tree comes from. So for us, now that we're seeing more blacks play quarterback in college and the pros, we would like to think that some of those guys would get an opportunity to coach that position, because that's where head coaches are coming
from. Look at T. Martin at USC. Was a quarterback in college, led Tennessee to a national championship, got a chance to be an offensive coordinator at a big school like USC. That, again, that's where it's going to come from. And I
4 years, but just got demoted in turn.
No, but he had a shot at USC. Yeah. That's great. That's
and it does. And then it also takes elevating those that are quarterbacks or offense coordinators. Eric Bieniemy, all the conversation in Kansas City has been about either Pat Mahomes or Andy Reid. Eric Bieniemy is the play caller.
Yes.
So we need to make sure that we give him his just due for putting together a dynamic offense and doing some of those things.
I'm going to go back to about success. And this is why I root for the National Football League to have success. Because one thing that I think has evened things out in professional football, it's so successful and there's so much money on the line and people are making so much money that they can't sit there and make racist decisions, because they want to make green decisions. Mm-hmm. Whatever will help me win and survive so I can continue to make this $4, $6, $7, $8 million a year as the head coach, that's the decision they're going to make. And as ownership, I just don't believe there's many. Maybe there are. If there's 32 NFL owners, maybe there's 10 of them, maybe there's 5 of them, maybe there's 4 of them. Maybe there's just only one of them. But I think most NFL owners are saying, who can help me win? And I don't care if they're green, blue, whatever color.
I think like where Greg is talking about or whatever, it's still an exposure thing, because this still is a relationship business. You have to be in a position where you meet people outside of the way Steve Wilks was hired. Steve Wilks went up to Steve Keim on vacation. They were at the same spot and said, hey, I'm Steve Wilks. I'm the defensive secondary coach for the Carolina Panthers. Steve Kime said, I never knew who he was prior to that. Mm. A year later, he hires him. So African-American coaches, coaches of color, they have to do a really good job of doing the networking part of the business, making themselves out there and available, meeting people so people are comfortable saying, oh, I know a good candidate outside of what is normally comfortable in terms of these are the people that I know.
And that networking has to evolve. I love the fact that you said those positions that were protected and how they have evolved to now. That's the focus and usually the nucleus for what they're going to look for in a new candidate. You got to understand this for everyone out there, black, white, whoever is aspiring to coach. I give you a parallel. Two of my best friends are Wall Streeters and working in the public sector, and they used to be investors in all things public. And you got, once something IPOs, oh, my God, everyone gets to feed off of it. Here's the thing now. The private sector has changed the game to the tune of like 400% in terms of technology investments, and Uber's a private company. You can't just go up to them and say, I want to invest in you, but guess what? They're worth $130 billion. So you can be in the old model and sit there and say, I have my mutual funds, and they're doing great. Or you can see what's new and what's next. And if you see that, it's the quarterback position by the rules, by the protection, and by the hires. So we used to think a different way, and that's part of the reason why there are not enough of us in these positions. But now let's change our thinking. Whitlock and Wiley, we're joined now by NBA champion Caron Butler. Let's move to the NBA, where we got another Shams bomb today with Yahoo Shams Charania reporting that Jimmy Butler has told the Timberwolves that he will sit out tonight's game against Utah, which is apparently just the beginning of a six-week-long process designed to get the All-Star traded out of Minnesota. Look, Caron, we're going to go right to you because you talked to Jimmy Butler today. What did he tell you? What should we think about this?
It was a mutual decision, which, you know, everyone know now is on the record. And it's not a thing that Jimmy wanted to, you know, jump out there and say too much about. But what he did state is that it's not a situation in which, look, I told them I want to get traded. They already know what the case is with him. But he's going to give 110% when he's out there. He is banged up. And he felt like he needed to rest. Mutual decision. Move forward.
Now, needed the rest, is that a one game? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, Woj countered this in saying that, no, he's going to travel with the team, he's going to rest, but continue to play. Is it continue to play after rest, or is it continue to rest? Because this is the six-week process.
It's all a game-to-game process. Ooh. And obviously, you know that there is a situation out there where it's four first-round draft picks that's on the table for the Timberwolves to decide on. And they're drawing a steep bargain with Houston. They're probably going to ask for more, like an Eric Gordon or something like that. You know, trade talks stopped before when they did it with Philadelphia when they asked to acquire Ben Simmons in the package. Hmm. That's not going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, Jimmy's helping his case by playing the way that he's playing at a high level, performing at a high rate, game winner over the Lakers the other day. So his value is high, and, you know, he's a must-get piece.
Caron, I watched that Lakers game pretty closely. Jimmy Butler was phenomenal, but one of the things I noticed is, like, I saw nothing communication-wise or celebratory-wise between him and Karl Anthony Towns. That riff seems like nothing fixes that. This situation is completely unsalvageable for Jimmy Butler to stay in Minnesota.
I think the organization see that as well. It's a situation in which to move forward, to truly move forward, you have to separate ties. And Jimmy understands that as well as anybody. He understands that. He went to the table with them in the offseason, and now this is something that carried over into the season. And you want to get this handled, addressed before the trade deadline and all that stuff pushes over. Otherwise, he's going to walk away in the free agency period.
Now, we don't count teammates' money, at least outside the Pittsburgh Steelers O-line. You're not supposed to do that, right? Let's be real about this. But if he were your teammate, you in the NBA, maybe a different mindset, culture, would you respect him for the way he's going about this, Jimmy Butler?
I will respect him for being honest as a player. Here's the thing. We all get shot, you know, from front office and management the way that, you know, they feel fits for the organization. And when you're a player that can kind of dictate and control your future and the forecast of your future, do that. Mm-hmm. And he was straight honest. He's not in a situation where he's in the locker room telling these guys he don't like playing with them and then addressed it with front office and management. He went there first. Now it's the trickle-down effect, and it's falling in place in vertical order. But now, going forward, get that man moved. That's how I see it. Like, you know, as a brother, as a friend, as a fan of the game, look, move on. I know you don't want to let an all-star go because anything can happen with the projection of the lottery picks. You don't know how they're going to plan out. But get him in a good situation.
How did Jimmy Butler get here? Like, do you first look at – because I've seen it go both ways. You look at your team, you're like, man, I need to get more out of these dudes. They're good, but they're not good enough. Or you just say, I need to get away from these guys. How did we get to the point where you just got to get away from them instead of trying to get more out of them?
Yeah, you know, sometimes with a player, it's almost looking at a situation and being like, can I truly win with these guys? Mm. I'm happy. I'm having fun. And that's huge. You saw that with superstars of the past and Chris Paul's situation when he was with the Clippers. Obviously, it's something that I would have loved to see him with the organization, stay with him. But was he happy? Was he having fun? He's having more fun in Houston. They're winning games, and you want to play with people that you can be the biggest asset with. And that's why I think Jimmy C, with his game, he wants to move forward and be in the right situation.
My concern if I'm Jimmy Butler is, and it's really my concern if I'm running the T-Wolves, he's kind of undermined their trade value even more by taking this drastic step. You know, they need to get rid of him as soon as possible, which I think hurts his trade value.
I think his trade value stays at a high level because of his performance. Every time he's on that platform, he's going out there, he's scoring 30 points with arguably the best player in all of basketball still in LeBron James. He's guarding him, he's performing, he's finishing, helping win games. Your value, your stock stay the same or even rise because people see the potential and what you still bring to the table. The deal need to get done. There's four first round picks that need to get done like yesterday.
Whitlock and Wiley.
Here.
Happy Halloween. Happy anti-social segment. Darnell Smith, our social media manager, is here to tell us what's happening out on those Twitter streets.
I thought we were all dressing up, man. Nah. What's going on?
You don't see Whitlock over here dressed up?
Grimace?
You don't see Bozo the Clown right here?
Get him.
All right. Look at the mess.
All right, Darnell, what's popping out there?
Yeah, we're going to start off with LeBron, who shared his Photoshop on Instagram of him teaming up with my guy, Kobe Bryant, AKA the second best player of all time. Mm. LeBron wrote, man, imagine if we had, it wouldn't even be, never mind, hashtag living legends. Huh? Sheesh, happy Halloween. I think LeBron is already begging for help from my man, Kobe, or is he just playing around here?
I don't get it.
Yeah, hanging around too many rappers. What's that? Sheesh. What you talking about LeBron talk? What you saying?
I don't get it. You already fantasizing about playing with Kobe 7 games in?
That was fast.
That was fast. And then the other day, he's throwing out congratulations to Klay Thompson. He's already recruiting for next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, LeBron looks thirsty.
Well, if he looks thirsty, he's always looked thirsty. He's always moved in this manner. Passive aggressive, just kind of subtle hints out there. Obviously, I think that because Kobe came on record and said, look, y'all can love me and still love LeBron. Maybe he was just trying to give that message some love and some respect for Kobe going out there. Kobe went to the game last week, their first win, and everyone said Kobe was the reason they won. Maybe a little too much of that love, but calm down.
He was. I agree.
Hold on. If you said to Kobe, second best player ever, he wouldn't even turn around. So what you talking about? He'd be like, what are you talking about? Like,
Kobe knows.
Oh, he knows.
You just a Clippers fan, you a hater.
A little bit.
All right, Darnell, what's next?
All right, we're going to talk a little bit of the Detroit Lions. Mm-hmm. We're a reporter tweet out today. I asked Patricia this morning about handling the roller coaster of being a new coach and dealing with a tough season. I give you his answer. But instead, we can look live at how he's handling the roller coaster of being a new head coach and dealing with a tough season. Take a listen.
Well, you know, do me a favor. Just kind of sit up and just, like, have a little respect for the class. Every day you come and ask me questions, mm-hmm. and you just kind of, like, you know, give me this. But, I mean, like, just be a little respectful in this whole
okay,
process.
That, okay, that's fine.
So
that's
ask me a question professionally, and I'll answer.
Okay.
I got a problem with him scolding a reporter here.
Listen, I went and got a little bit of the backstory. He's actually scolding Mike Rothstein, I think, from ESPN, who's covered the team for 5 or 6 years and is a bit of a troll. He asks questions constantly, poking the bear, and he's laying back kind of disrespectfully or whatever. It's a terrible look for Patricia. But I think if you're on the ground in Detroit, you kind of get why he did it.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, Patricia was written off after week one, right?
Yeah.
And then it's kind of roared back a little bit, 3-4 record, but there's some good wins in there. Sooner or later, maybe now,
Matt Patricia's going to flex. Like, you can't be, just letting y'all know this is coming, okay? You around Bill Belichick, you got a pencil, but you ain't got nothing to write on. Like, that dude is going to flex, and I think he's maybe appropriate in this moment, but trust me, somebody's going to get the smoke from Matt Patricia. It's just a matter of time.
All right, Darnell, what's next?
Yeah, sticking with coaches here. Y'all discussed Hugh Jackson being fired earlier in the show, which seemed inevitable after he was on the dreaded hot seat for the past year and a half. Coaches from the NFL to NBA to college hoops are always feeling the heat. And Whitlock's boy Frank Martin tweeted an interesting theory. I read all these articles written by media guys, most of which I respect, about coaching hot seats. I think we coaches need to start a media guy hot seat list. What do you think? Y'all like this idea?
I love it, and I would love to be. Well, I'm not a coach, so I couldn't participate, but I could leak them names anonymously.
You would, of course. That's how you roll.
On the media hot seat. I guess Jason Witten would probably be at the top of the list.
Right? Oh man, that ain't anonymous. That's the chorus. Witten gotta go. Look, but, I would like it too, just in a competitive atmosphere. Like, yeah, come at us. But except we talk, and I don't know if we have the same objective standards. Like, it's not a win-loss game. It's not just ratings-based. Is your show making money? Are you sponsored? Is it bought out? Like, we got to find the criteria. But, yeah, bring the smoke.
My seat has been hot now for 28 years. I graduated college in 1990, and I've been on the hot seat for 28 years.
I would love it.
I'm all burnt up and roasted. I'm ready to go.
Rotisserie over here.
Right. Rotisserie with
it. They're spinning around.
They spinning. All right, what's next?
Yeah, last but not least. So the college football playoff rankings came out, and obviously Alabama's number one. So our guys over at First Things First had an interesting theory. Take a listen.
Chris and I both agree that it is overwhelmingly likely that nobody beats Alabama
this year. I think
this
is the best Alabama team in the history since Bear Bryant coached Alabama, yes.
And so, neither one of us are picking Alabama to lose to a team.
What do you guys like this year, Alabama or the field?
Strong. That is strong.
They got to get out this week. I mean, LSU on the road, that's not easy. But, look, they're a better team than LSU. Respect to what they are doing. It's just because of the quarterback. Alabama's usually built on defense, power running game, and just keeping it close. But now they have an offense and Tua at the quarterback position. That changes the entire dynamic. I understand where he's coming from. I would go Alabama against the field.
I think I would take Alabama against the field, too, because we've always said with Nick Saban, it's like, if he ever has a quarterback, what's it going to be like?
Well.
And now he has a quarterback, and the best one in college football. Who knows if Tua is going to be a great pro, but he has the best. This is kind of like Tim Tebow. And I'm not comparing. Tua's got more upside than Tebow.
Right.
But Tebow was the best quarterback in college football, and Florida was really hard to beat. This Alabama team with Tua is damn near impossible to beat.
Squad.
I wouldn't even like my Ball State Cardinals against this team.
How about Warren? I think Warren could probably compete.
You're absolutely right.
Or at least
Warren
I
Central, we could compete for.
So you the guy that goes out the night before Halloween, huh? Because obviously you hung. What are you talking about? Ball State? Y'all can't even beat. You can't even talk. Who y'all got? Toledo?
Toledo tonight on the road.
Maxton. What's that score going to be?
I don't want to talk about it. Our quarterback's hurt.
Yeah.
We're going to give him a good game.
Your team is hurt.
All right.
Sure, baby.
Thank you, Darnell. All right, today we're talking about Cam Newton, who is having one of his best years of his career and is fresh off a blowout win over the Ravens' top-ranked defense. All right, listen, I struggle with this one. I got to be honest with you. I went back and forth. I'm a Cam Newton fan. He's having a great year. He's having a John Elway type season. Love the guy. So I gave him a 24 in job performance. You can't be playing much better than he is right now.
That's up there.
I have him third in my MVP race. 19 in all-time great status. Hadn't won a Super Bowl, so I don't want to get anywhere in the 20s. Authenticity, a 20. But here's where I struggle with character, where I think I've probably gone a little too high at 15 for a grand total of 78 all-star status. But I think character, I've cut the guy a lot of breaks here. He's got a lot of little issues.
Yeah, so you landed at the right place, but she don't like it necessarily how you got there.
Nah.
In terms of character.
Nah.
Ah, man, I hear you there. My ratings, approval rating, kind of similar in terms of the aggregate number. I do have him in GOAT status, just barely crossing that border at 81. But job performance, I'm with you, 23. Patrick Mahomes is out there playing a little better at the position. But other than that, still respect to him. 18.
all-time greatness. You won't forget about Cam Newton. You certainly won't forget about the tangibles and how he's able to play the game in a rare fashion. Authenticity 23. I like Cam, man. Towel over my head. Everyone criticizes him. So what? Towel over my head. You don't like me giving the ball to the kids? So what? Giving the ball to the kids. You don't like me dancing? So what? I'm dancing. Love that. Character 17 for me. Has some issues.
Thrown out of Florida. Had the press conference last year about the female reporter.
Yeah, that was bad. That's bad. That's why you're not 25. Okay.
You know.
What else we got? Stealing the laptop. Is that really? Yeah. I was a thief when I was in high school.
Kids football camp, I think.
Oh, that was bad, too.
And, you know, I hate to say it because I'm going to catch some heat for this, but has he married the young lady he's got the kids with? You know, I don't. My mother wouldn't like that. Oh, they are married now?
I don't know.
They're not married.
My mother wouldn't like that. I am not holding them to that standard.
My mother, I'm just saying.
Yeah, okay.
You got two kids. Okay. Put a ring on it, Marcella.
Two kids, yeah.
You got two kids. Put a ring
on it. That is a ring. You forever were in her life with them kids. Like, I don't care what the court says.
Put a ring on it, make it official.
You're not going anywhere.